What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Every Monday on Law and Disorder, we spend a full hour covering the genocide in Palestine in an effort to disrupt and push back on the misinformation and disinformation that mainstream media is spewing at the behest of the Israeli government. It has been 617 days since October 7, 2023, and in that time, the Zionist occupying state of Israel has claimed over 70,000 Palestinian lives, which is an undercount, of which the majority have been women, children, and elders. Here on Law and Disorder, we have spent the majority of those Mondays bringing you Palestine Post, where we push back on the mainstream media's misinformation and disinformation. We start today's Palestine Post with Curry Peterson-Smith, Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he researches U.S. empire, borders, and migration. Happened, Curry. Good morning.
Good morning, Kat.
Oh, it's been a minute. Lots of stuff to talk about, but I want to start with Iran and Israel. I was actually on vacation for a little bit, and for once turned off the headlines and came back to so much happening. You and I talked about Iran-Israel tensions escalating into an actual war conflict. We also talked about how silly it would be for either the U.S. or Israel to attack a country who perhaps also has nuclear weapons and super likely aren't afraid to use them. We'll start just with your broad thoughts on what's happening there.
Well, I mean, broadly speaking, of course, this is catastrophic. You know, I mean, Israel has, in so many ways, this is one of the worst things. There's a lot of people whose worst nightmares are coming true right now. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? A lot of Palestinians who have feared the kind of genocide that Israel's carrying out in Gaza. A lot of Lebanese, you know, a lot of Yemenis and Syrians and now Iranians whose nightmares are coming true. And Israel started this with an unprovoked attack on Iranian military facilities and cities. Yeah. And they continue to expand the bombing of the cities. And of course, they provoked a predictable response by Iran, which has a lot more military capability than the other places that Israel has attacked in these past 20 months. And so predictably, we are seeing casualties within Israel's borders as well. And this is a kind of horrifying but predictable kind of situation of escalation, right? Without an end in sight at the moment. So it's really horrifying. It's really, really horrifying.
We're going to stay here for a few more minutes. Curry Peterson-Smith, Netanyahu says Israel attacked Iran because of concerns of nuclear capability, which he deemed a threat to the survival of Israel. In an interview on NPR, UN Iranian relations expert Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, told NPR that Israel does not want to see the U.S. and Iran resolve their problems and improve the relationship. Quoting, says this quote, the Israelis calculate that even if there is an improvement in U.S.-Iran relations and a reduction in U.S.-Iran tensions, it will not be accompanied by a reduction in Israeli-Iranian tensions. So the Israelis have, for more than 20 years, tried to sabotage any diplomacy between the United States and Iran. I don't know that we can say that the U.S. has been engaging in diplomacy with Iran over the last two decades, but, you know, your thoughts about that statement as part of the real reason why we're watching Israel do what Israel's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, there's a question about, the extent of good faith, you know, with which Washington approaches any negotiation. But it is the case that Trump, went back to the negotiating table with Iran for whatever reason. And we do know that Trump thinks of himself as a deal maker. He's somebody who, in his way, sees himself as something of a peacemaker. I said peace in quotes, but you know, keep in mind. I mean, it is worth remembering that before he took office, he said, "I'm going to end the war in Ukraine overnight. I'm going to end, you know, this war in Gaza, and I'm going to get a deal with Iran." Right. You know, if there was anything genuine about that, if you know, if we could take any of that at face value, he's 0-3. So you know, Israel absolutely has worked to undermine any negotiations between the U.S. and Iran. Let's put aside Trump for a second and go back to the Obama administration, who did negotiate, you know, a nuclear deal with Iran. We can talk about the nature of that deal. What does it mean that the United States, the only country in world history to actually use atomic weapons in a war, gets to decide that Iran can't have a nuclear program, or, you know, the limits on Iran's nuclear program. But there was a deal that was made, and Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu in particular worked to undermine that. And so, yeah, it is. I do think that the context for this Israeli attack that has now launched this war is, you know, a big part of the context is these negotiations. And in fact, they were supposed to have negotiations, go back to the negotiating table yesterday on Sunday. And of course, the Israeli strikes began on Friday. And now those negotiations aren't happening.
Right. That's a segue into how I was going to start my next question, but you've done that for me already. So I'll jump to, and I think we should note here actually that while the U.S. hasn't been involved directly in the attacks on Iran, Trump has admitted that the United States knew about it. Yes. And has done, you know, what he normally does, which is blame the folks being attacked as opposed to the attackers and, you know, saying, you know, well, we told them if they didn't, you know, do what we said, then, you know, I think it was something like worse than anything they could imagine was coming their way. Curry, we've spoken before about Israel overstretching its military capacity. And so I was thinking about this morning. So they are in Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. Military mistake. I mean, like... Right. That's a lot of places to be at war,
right?
Committing genocide.
While seizing territory in Syria and bombing Yemen regularly. I mean,
right.
You know, yeah, I do think, I mean, obviously, look, there's this open-ended Israeli offensive. You and I have talked about this, unfortunately, for months, that, you know, not only is this offensive flowing from Israeli politics right now, which is incredibly belligerent, but also Netanyahu personally, he has a personal stake in making sure that these various military operations go on for as long as possible, because as long as that's happening, he gets to defer the many trials, the many charges that he faces for corruption, you know? And unlike the U.S., Israel heads of state, you know, high-ranking officials, including heads of state, can go to prison, you know, for crimes. So he has a personal stake in drawing this out. And the logic of this offensive is expansion. You know what I mean? Like he, and we've seen that, unfortunately, again, all the countries that you named over these 20 months. But yes, of course, there are limits to the Israeli military. In fact, prior to this attack on Iran, there was a growing conversation in Israeli society about the number of Israeli reservists who are not showing up for duty, which interestingly is that's kind of allowed in Israel. You know, like you can be called up and decide not to go and you don't necessarily face punishment for it. There has been a conversation about the number of Israeli soldiers traumatized by what they have done and what they have experienced. And of course, there is always a conversation about the hardware, the military hardware for which Israel is entirely dependent on the United States, really. I mean, even the Israeli tanks, you know, they depend on U.S. spare parts. They need a ton of maintenance spare parts. The same thing with the aircraft. The aircraft are U.S. aircraft. The bombs, the munitions, they come from the United States. And there's a limit to those things. And so, yeah, is now launching a war with Iran from the Israeli military perspective, is that a smart move? I don't think so, for a number of reasons. I do think that at the moment, Netanyahu has resolved the question of his unpopularity. You know, the for a number of reasons, many of which do not have to do with the humanitarian reality of for Palestinians in Gaza. What's happening in Gaza is becoming, and with Israel's genocide there is becoming unpopular among Israelis. Attacking Iran, however, is very popular with Israelis, and so politically he has, he's got a win in quotes, but militarily, can they keep this up forever? No, of course not.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. This is Palestine Post, where we spend the full hour every Monday covering Israel's genocidal attacks on Palestine and the ripple effect across the region. We are speaking with Curry Peterson Smith, Michael Ratner, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Curry, interestingly enough, I guess not surprising howsoever, the attack on Iran is splitting Donald Trump's base, not because they care about Iranians or, but because they feel, the right-wing politicians and commentators, including Tucker Carlson, who released a statement, feel that unconditional support with Israel is at odds with the quote-unquote America First platform on which Trump was elected. And they've largely turned skeptical of Israel and believe that these types of wars are what caused Republican presidencies to become failures and their broader domestic agenda to be compromised. What's the opportunity here, Curry?
Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, let's talk about there's a number of problems on their end. You know, I think that's right, that the support for Israel does contradict this, what Trump has said rhetorically, which is that he's against more wars. And then I do think a part of his base, they support that. And frankly, this Israeli, war with Iran, I mean, it's not many degrees of separation. Let's put it this way: it's not many degrees of separation removed from U.S. military personnel. So there's 40,000 U.S. troops in the Middle East right now, and the U.S. is sending more as there is an active and expanding combat situation. Every time they send another ship, and right now they're sending two destroyers, that's another group of U.S. personnel who are in harm's way. There are U.S. troops. Right. In Iraq, and the U.S. is carrying out some of these operations, so-called defensive operations, against Iranian projectiles from their bases in Iraq, and so, that of course opens the possibility of U.S. personnel being hurt, which of course points to the U.S. getting involved. And yeah, there's a section of Trump's base who doesn't want that. The truth is that what's interesting is that section of Trump's base is part of a majority, it's actually a majority of Americans, let's say, are weary of war, are skeptical of war. I mean, a majority of Americans actually oppose the U.S. support for Israel and what it's doing, the genocide is carrying out in Gaza. A majority of Americans support stopping U.S. military aid for that genocide. And majority of Americans don't want to see U.S. troops involved in war. So the opportunity and really the responsibility, I think, is to make that opposition real and say there's a political price to pay for U.S. support of what Israel's doing and definitely a political price to pay for U.S. involvement.
Yeah, and, as an organizer, looking at the cracks in the infrastructure of the enemy, really thinking about where is there an opportunity to reach out to folks, because right, organizing 101, no permanent enemies, no permanent friends, and we don't always think like that on the left, right? We very often are no, you're over there and you're that person, as opposed to being here's an opportunity to increase the numbers for this particular goal. Now, once we reach that goal, we may go our separate ways and be at odds again, but in the moment, right, the current crisis, I think, demands, as we've talked about, actually new tools, new thinking, and creative ways of having conversations with folks that maybe on the outset, right at first glance, are folks that we wouldn't even want to be in the same room with. I digress. Meanwhile, as Israel attacks Iran, it has also locked down the West Bank. There are checkpoints everywhere. Right, we've been watching this escalation for some time at this point, but it's locked down the West Bank. There are checkpoints everywhere. When Palestinians try to approach these checkpoints, they met with fire from Israeli soldiers. There have been even more folks expelled from their homes. Settler violence has escalated, continues to escalate, I should say. And, you know, of course, there's the repetitive blatant statements that Israel intends to annex the entire West Bank to build more settler colonies. I'm wondering if you see any correlation, and I think this goes back to my question about, like, overstretch in terms of military, military utilization. Any correlation between what Israel is doing in Iran and the lockdown of the West Bank?
Well, I think that, I mean, as you point out, the idea of formally annexing the West Bank, saying, this is legally formally known as occupied Palestinian territory. You know, obviously we know that it's Palestinian land, but like legally, according to international law, this is occupied Palestinian territory. Israel doesn't really see it that way. They see, you know, they have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, I believe, Israeli settlers across the West Bank. And, you know, in the Israeli news or whatever, you know, they refer to this as basically part of Israel. They want to formally do that and formally annex the West Bank. And in practice, that's what they have been doing. And frankly, they have used, you know, the catastrophic genocide in Gaza, you know, horrific beyond words in its own right. Israel has also taken the opportunity, the fact that that attention is rightly focused on Gaza, to intensify what it's doing in the West Bank. And I think they're similarly going to do, they're going to do a similar thing with Iran. You know, I mean, now that, again, it is right and important for us to recognize what Israel's doing with Iran, recognize the U.S. involvement, oppose all of that. And at the same time, you know, the killing continues in Gaza. The starvation continues in Gaza. And yeah, the operations to further annex the West Bank and put pressure on the West Bank and occupy the West Bank, that also continues. And so, you know, I think a challenge, you spoke to this question as an organizer, you know, our movement, on one hand, the capacity that the movement of folks here in this country who are calling attention to U.S. and Israeli crimes in Palestine, the capacity that we have now versus before October 20th, 23, there's no comparison. I mean, that's right. Our capacity has expanded incredibly.
Right.
And with that expanding capacity, you know, we're going to have to do a lot of things at once. And that includes keeping the attention on Gaza, keeping the attention on the West Bank, and of course, rallying in opposition to what Israel is doing and what the U.S. is supporting with Iran.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to my next guest about the importance of strategic solidarity, right? Not just presumptive solidarity between all of the resistance that is happening right now. Curry Peterson-Smith, in Lebanon, Hezbollah and Iranian, backed military groups have stayed out of the fray. Hezbollah is supposed to be one of Iran's first lines of defense. Are they too busy responding to what Israel is actually doing in Lebanon, or do you think there's other reasons they would remain on the sidelines?
Yeah, I mean, it just, the level of devastation in Lebanon, you know, not only is it so real, but it continues. I mean, Israel, they just bombed Lebanon again last week. You know, they still have forces operating in southern Lebanon. And so, yeah, I do think that it's a question of Hezbollah are dealing with what's happening in Lebanon at the moment. I mean, it must be said, you know, there has been a huge setback militarily. Absolutely.
Right. And, you know, I'm not a military strategist by any means, but if I look at the order in which Israel launched these attacks, right, Lebanon, Syria, and then Iran, I can't help but assume that they knew that Hezbollah would be busy dealing with them and therefore could not engage in their plans to attack Iran. Because I don't believe that they just decided to do that last Friday. When they attacked Beirut a week ago, Israel said that the bombing would continue and escalate if Hezbollah is not disarmed. And as I'm read that, I'm like, okay, first of all, who can disarm Hezbollah? Certainly not the shell of the Lebanese government, right? I mean, so the demand is ridiculous. And again, I don't believe that the Israeli government doesn't know that. And secondly, what do you think escalation, I mean, it's already horrific, could look like? I mean, the only thing that I can think is that they're just trying to get repeats of the genocide in Gaza and all of these places.
There is any number of things that they have piloted in Gaza, you know, that we're now seeing elsewhere, that we're seeing in the West Bank, that where we hadn't seen those particular tactics before. Similarly, in Lebanon, absolutely. And frankly, with Iran, there's any number of things that they've done in Gaza that they want to do elsewhere. You know, there's an Israeli phrase for this. They call it the curve of escalation, you know? And it's exactly what you said. I mean, this has been an Israeli conversation. We're going to start with Gaza, and then we're going to move on, you know, up, you know, what they see as the curve. So, you know, I said a minute ago that militarily there's something, these resources are finite, you know, there's only so far they can go. And there's a certain truth in that. But if our side, meaning the social movements, don't stop them, you know, they will regroup. Because while on one hand, you know, there's a kind of a finite human reality to the Israeli military. There's a finite reality of munitions and so on coming from the United States. The Israelis try to make up that gap with technology. You know, that's why they're leaning on drones and tech like that in Gaza. And again, it comes back here. Those, you know, that technology, even the Israeli drones, they're made with components in the United States. It's financed from the United States. You know, Israel is economically dependent on the United States. And of course, the munitions that they're dropping and the planes that they're dropping them from, they come from the United States. So, you know, on one hand, they are stretched. Israel is stretched in a way that they have not been. And that affords us an opportunity and a responsibility to stop this. But that's what we have to do.
Curry, one more question for you, and then I need to move on to my next guest. I'm sure you're tracking the planned UN conference next week on a two-state solution. It's almost like, as we've been having this conversation over the last 617 days, that like we just saw what was coming. So we've got this UN conference on the two-state solution and conversation, again, we've had before. I'm trying to grasp what the terms would be. And sort of baffled that anyone thinks this is even a viable conversation to be having at this point, right? Because we long ago reached sort of the point of no return, as we've talked about. And that said, I have seen some Palestinian pundits say that the agreement to a two-state solution is a critical first irreversible step, even though it won't solve, quote unquote, everything. Your thoughts?
Respectfully. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of a conversation about a two-state solution, that I understand why that conversation was compelling at certain points in the 20th century. Looking at the state of the West Bank now, mm-hmm. with the number of Israeli settlements and settlers there, and, you know, checkpoints and military and, you know, looking at the state of Gaza right now, I don't understand how one could seriously entertain, you know, the notion of a two-state solution of the kind that they are discussing. Yeah. And so I think what I think is more, I hope that what does not get lost are other moves that various UN member states are making. For example, you know, five states sanctioning Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, these two fascist Israeli ministers, increasing numbers actually talking about and taking steps to limit weapons to Israel and things like that. That kind of thing is happening, and I think is a lot more compelling than what can only be a rhetorical conversation about a two-state solution.
Curry Peterson-Smith, I've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm so glad that you were one of our first guests as we've expanded to live streaming live radio in Los Angeles. We will talk to you again soon.
I'm very grateful. Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.